The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? And we're here this week with Michael Cremo. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, I am. Good to be with you and all your listeners.
All right. And you sort of kind of made it into the world of alternative archaeology with your first book, Forbidden Archaeology. Is that true?
That's correct. That's what brought me into the subject area, yeah.
And how did you get interested in this?
Well, that has a lot to do with the way I was raised. My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. And, you know, that meant a few things for me as I was growing up. First of all, it meant I was living in lots of different places in the United States, Hawaii, overseas, places in Europe, and things like that. And that had the effect of letting me understand there's more than one way of looking at things. You know, there are different people in different parts of the world who have different ways of looking at things. And I got exposed to a lot of different cultures and ideas and things like that. So that was a big influence on me. For example, when I was 16 years old, I was going to an American high school, military high school in Germany. And on one of my vacations, I went to Sweden. I was staying in a youth hostel in Stockholm. And, you know, I met some European kids who had traveled overland to India and back. You could do that in those days, a little more difficult now. But, you know, they were telling me about the Ganges River and the Himalayan Mountains and yogis and things like that they met over there. And so I became a little bit interested in India and things connected with India. So whenever I would find some book of Indian philosophy or something like that, I'd pick it up and read it. And in 1974, at a Grateful Dead concert in upstate New York, I got a copy of Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the spiritual texts of ancient India, and eventually I became a disciple of a guru or spiritual master from India, and then I began a more systematic study of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, and among them are a group called the Puranas, which means the histories, and in them, you know, there are accounts of human populations existing on Earth millions of years ago, which is something that's very, very different from anything I had learned from my teachers in high school or university. They were teaching the standard modern scientific idea that humans like us first appeared less than 200,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like human ancestors, whereas these ancient Sanskrit writings and the writings of other ancient wisdom traditions were presenting another picture where you have humans existing from the very beginnings of life on Earth, going back many millions of years. So that's what got me. I was interested in, well, is that just mythology, or is there perhaps some factual basis for it? So that's what got me started looking into the history of archaeology, because that's the science of human origins and antiquity. So when I looked in the current textbooks of archaeology, I didn't see any evidence for extreme human antiquity. But I decided, okay, I'm not going to stop with the textbooks. I'm going to look a little bit deeper. I'm going to go back to the original scientific reports, published in many different languages because of the way I was raised and educated. I have a reading knowledge of German, French, Italian, Spanish, and a lot of other languages. So I was inspired to kind of dig into the original scientific reports in archaeology from the time of Darwin all the way up to the present in many different languages. And when I started looking at those original scientific reports, I found many, many instances of archaeologists and geologists and paleontologists reporting discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back much further in time than 200,000 years, going back millions of years, tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. So I collected all of those reports, and it took about 8 years to do the research, and that evidence I compiled into the book Forbidden Archaeology.
And you did that with...
That's how I kind of got into that whole topic.
Now, you wrote that with Richard Thompson, didn't you?
Yeah. Richard Thompson and I put that book together. We started the research in around 1984, and the book was published in 1993.
And he's actually a Cornell graduate right from here.
Yeah, he's no longer living. A few years ago, he left this world. But yeah, he did get a PhD in mathematics from Cornell. Yeah.
So what was the initial reaction to Forbidden Archaeology?
Well, do you mean from the scientific world?
Well, yeah, from the scientific world.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because the scientific world isn't monolithic. Basically, I found there were three different reactions from three different groups of scientists and academics. There's one group that I call the fundamentalist materialists, who are just very much attached to the current theories, and they don't want to hear anything else. And they didn't really like what the book was saying. They didn't want to hear about it, and they didn't want anybody else to hear about it. So, they said some pretty negative things about it. So that was one reaction. And I was expecting that.
Right.
I was expecting that reaction. Now, what I found a little more interesting is there's another group of scientists who may accept the current theories, but they're willing to listen to alternatives and consider evidence that may contradict the current theories. And it was scientists and academics in that group who would invite me to speak at universities, who said some positive things about the book and their published reviews of it. You know, for example, there was a prominent historian of science named David Oldroyd, originally from England. And, you know, he wrote a 21-page review article about the book in an academic journal. And he asked the question, he's saying, does this book make a contribution to the scientific literature on paleoanthropology, in other words, the science of human origins? And he and his co-author said yes, for a couple of reasons. One reason, they said, was they had encountered no one who had gone into the history of archaeology in such depth before. And second, they said we did a good job in raising some questions about the truth value of the current dominant theories. So there were some scientists who were reacting in a very negative way, saying this is just pure hogwash, but then there were others who were more open-minded, who were willing to admit that perhaps what we were doing in the book Forbidden Archaeology had some academic and scientific value. There was another archaeologist who wrote a review in the British Journal for History of Science, an archaeologist named Tim Murray, and he said, you know, the book provided case studies for the epistemology of archaeology. You know, epistemology is the branch of knowledge that deals with how do we know things? What is the nature of evidence? What is... So he thought we made a good contribution in providing case studies that would help archaeologists understand the epistemology of their discipline. Hmm. I'm not saying that these people, they agreed with everything, all the conclusions of the book, but they just saw some value in it, which I think is an important first step. You know,
oh, yeah.
Because if you know, ideas are going to change, the first thing has to be that some scientists and academics have to be willing to listen to new ideas. And fortunately, some of them are. Now, among those who do listen, some of them actually agree with me. Now, I'm going to say that they are few in number today. That is a fact. So those were basically the three kinds of reactions. Some very negative reactions, some more open-minded reactions, admitting some possible value in the work, and then some few actually agreeing with the conclusions.
Now, the people more on the fringes of archaeology, the people like Graham Hancock and such, were very impressed by your work. I mean, they put that down in their books. They reference you a lot. Was that the general reaction you found from that grouping?
Well, from the alternative archaeology and alternative history group, yes, there was a generally very positive reaction. Now, I'm not going to say that even within the alternative group, they all agree with me.
Right, yeah, right.
But the alternative archaeology and alternative history field is a pretty big field. And there are lots of different areas of research. Many of the researchers are specializing in the more... on the more recent end of the time spectrum, you know, going back about 50,000, 25,000
right.
years and considering what's going on there. You know, because the mainstream idea is that civilization, you know, developed urban type of civilization, you know, like the classic Egyptian culture and ancient Chinese and Indian cultures, they think that only goes back about 7,000 or 8,000 years, maybe a maximum of 10,000 years for the first settled village life. So there are a lot of researchers who are kind of gradually pushing things back, you know, beyond 10,000 years to 20,000 years, 30,000 years or more for civilization. Like Robert Schock is in that category.
Right.
Graham Hancock,
Robert
as well.
Yeah.
So, and I've kind of taken the other end of the alternative spectrum, the deep history of the human species going back many millions of years. So, I think that there was a good reaction. I mean, Graham Hancock actually wrote a foreword for the abridged edition of Forbidden Archaeology called The Hidden History of the Human Race, where he has some very positive things to say about the research. I think he called it one of the landmark intellectual achievements of the late 20th century, because that's when the book appeared. So, yeah, there's, you know, from that element, but even within that element, I think if you asked some of the researchers if they agree with all my conclusions, they would say no.
Right. Well,
but
yeah.
But many of them did appreciate the book when it first came out. That's a fact.
But you got a more positive response from the sort of alternative archaeologists than from the mainstream ones.
In general. Yeah. But even within the mainstream, there have been some positive reactions, which I think is a positive sign. I think the very fact, you know, for example, that I've been able to present 30 or 40 papers at mainstream scientific conferences about my work is one sign of that. So within, you know, the mainstream, like I said, there have been three basic reactions. This very heavily negative reaction from some of the more strict followers of the current theories, and then the more open-minded ones who are at least willing to give some consideration and acknowledge some positive aspects to my work, and then the few that actually agree with it. Now, within the alternative community, there's the alternative history archaeology community, there's kind of general appreciation for what I do, so... That's a fact. Yeah.
And after that, I mean, that book was very... You wrote Forbidden Archaeology from a very scientific point of view. You laid out facts. You explored them. You showed how some evidence was thrown out that should have been... That was really good evidence, and other evidence is accepted that wasn't very good evidence. But you did it all in a very scientific format. And
That book was intended basically for an academic and scientific audience, although I did understand that there would be other people who would be interested in it. And we did bring out that original book, Forbidden Archaeology, is about 900 pages long. So we did bring out a shorter edition of the book, about 300 pages long, for people who might not have wanted to go through 900 pages. So that book is called Hidden History of the Human Race.
And then after that, you explored more of the religious aspect as well, correct?
Yeah, well, the first thing I did was, you know, people would always ask me, you know, what's been the reaction of scientists to your work, or what's been the reaction of people to your work? So I put out a book called Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, which is not a big seller, but it was a compilation of all the different things that scientists said in their reviews of the book and my correspondence with them. And, you know, it was meant to answer the question I was getting from my readers, what's been the reaction to Forbidden Archaeology from various categories of people. So I wanted to document that, and I did in the book Forbidden Archaeology's Impact. But then another question people would ask after they read Forbidden Archaeology was along these lines. They would say, okay, you've presented all this archaeological evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origin. And, you know, you're showing that, okay, there are human bones, human footprints, human artifacts that go back millions of years. So now if you don't accept the current Darwinian evolutionary explanation of where we came from, and you've presented all this evidence that contradicts it, then where do you think we came from? Now, to answer that question, I wrote a book called Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And what I proposed there was that, you know, before we even asked the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now today, many scientists are going to say that a human being or any other living thing is just a complex machine made of molecules, made of matter. They would say that's what we are. And as far as our consciousness is concerned, they would just say, okay, if you organize the molecules in the brain in a very complex way, they produce what we call consciousness, but only as long as those chemicals are organized. when the chemicals become disorganized at the time of death, there's no more consciousness, nothing that survives the death of the body. So it's a very materialistic picture of what we are. So what I was proposing is that consciousness has its own independent existence apart from matter. Matter does not produce consciousness, but consciousness can come into association with matter. It can become covered by matter. So originally, consciousness exists in a pure state, beyond time, beyond the limits of matter. If consciousness becomes covered by matter, that's what I call devolution, the process by which a pure conscious self descends from some higher level of reality into the world of matter and becomes associated with matter and covered by matter. So it's a process that can be reversed. I mean, the devolution can be reversed and consciousness can be restored to its original pure state. So that's the message I was trying to get across in the book Human Devolution, that as conscious human beings, we don't evolve up from matter, rather we devolve or come down from pure consciousness. And that involves demonstrating the scientific evidence that consciousness can exist apart from the brain, apart from matter, apart from the body. And there are various categories of scientific evidence that show that. Medical studies of out-of-body experiences, psychiatric studies of past life memories, and things of that sort. So that's what that book is about. And I've always been very open about the spiritual inspiration and background for my work. Like I was explaining at the top of the show, the whole reason I got into studying the history of archaeology was my encounter with the accounts of extreme human antiquity that are found in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Without that, I wouldn't have had any reason to question what I'd always learned in school.
Right.
So, but now, in terms of my presentations, however, I wouldn't expect anybody in the scientific world or in the universities or even among the general public to accept what I say just on the basis of a statement from some ancient book of knowledge. I think they have a right to expect that, well, I might have some idea that comes from some ancient book of knowledge, okay, but there should be some justification for that in terms of scientific evidence and logic, which I give. I wouldn't expect anybody who's not part of my spiritual tradition to accept what I say just on the basis of some statement from some ancient book of knowledge.
Right, right. Okay, hang on for 1 second. I got to play this, and we're going to be right back with Michael Cremo.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, so this is Where Did the Road Go? We're on the air with Michael Cremo. And so now, Michael, you have a new work called My Science, My Religion. What are the elements of that?
Well, that book is a collection of 24 papers that I've presented at major international scientific conferences on archaeology and anthropology and history of science. And I've presented more papers than that, but this is a selection of 24 papers that I've presented over the years at these major international scientific conferences about work related to forbidden archaeology, you know, evidence for extreme human antiquity, and evidence for my alternative ideas about human origins that I expressed in my book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. So I think it's important that people are aware that these sorts of things are being presented not just to alternative science types of audiences, like on radio shows like this or other radio shows in this genre, or at conferences where people are discussing alternative science topics like UFOs and paranormal and alternative history and things like that. It is a fact that I do present these ideas in those circles and through that sort of media. But I think it's important that people realize that I am also presenting these things at major international scientific conferences. And I called this book My Science, My Religion because I am very open about the spiritual inspiration for what I do. I'm very open about the connection my ideas have with the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And however, I justify these ideas with scientific evidence. So many people think that in the world, the scientific world today, science and religion have to be kept completely separate. I am living proof that even within the world of scientific conferences, it's possible to integrate scientific work with religious inspiration in a way that's acceptable at a certain level to the scientific world. And I think it's very important that people are aware of that, which is why I brought out this latest book, My Science, My Religion, which is, as I said, a collection of 24 papers that I presented on these topics at major international scientific conferences.
Do you think there are people who are just not even going to consider your work because of the term religion being involved?
Well, I think there are some like that, but there are others who are interested in these things. I think we're going through a period in the world's intellectual history where there's more and more interest in integrating spiritual perspectives into scientific perspectives. There's an understanding that this divorce between science and religion that took place several centuries ago was in one sense productive for science, and that, you know, they decided they were going to focus strictly on matter operating according to material laws. That was very productive in a sense. They were able to get a lot of understanding out of it. They were able to get a lot of technology out of it, you know, pharmaceuticals, weapons, consumer products out of it, but at a cost of having an incomplete worldview, a worldview that left out things like consciousness, for example, and the idea that there might be some higher intelligence involved in some of the order and complexity that we observe around us. So it was very productive in one sense, but in another sense, it it resulted in an incomplete understanding of the universe and the life force within it. Well, so within science today, there are more and more people who are beginning to try to bridge the gap. And science and religion is now a huge area of study. There are academic journals on science and religion. There are whole conferences about science and religion. I'm living proof of a person who's able to circulate in the world of science with a religious perspective. So there are some who resist that. There are some who are open to it. It's like whenever you take a stand on anything, you know, some people are going to like it, some people aren't going to like it. That's the nature of life.
Well, it seems like, especially in this country, when you mention science and religion, the first thing that comes to mind are Christian creationists, not so much people who are bringing in the spirituality of India and such into the work.
Yeah, I mean, it may be one reason why I've attracted a little bit of attention, because usually, you know, people aren't very familiar with, you know, as you say, you know, when people think of science and religion, they think science versus Christianity or fundamentalist Christianity.
Or people who are doing the opposite of you and trying to prove that the world's only 6,000 years old so that it lines up with their biblical beliefs.
Yeah, well, here's what I would say. I would say, I mean, although I disagree with such people, I think that they have a right to express their ideas. And I think they have to have justification. You know, they shouldn't expect people to, in the scientific world and in the educational world, to accept their ideas just on the basis of a statement from the Bible, for example.
Right.
They should be able, in scientific circles, to present scientific evidence and logic that would justify ideas that they have got from their sacred text. And I think that's legitimate, and mm-hmm. I think it should be allowed. Now, I wouldn't say that they have the right to take control of the education system and dictate to everyone what they should believe. I believe in the right of each individual to make up their own minds about these things, which is one reason I don't like it very much that the supporters of the current theories of human origins and antiquity have managed to get a government-enforced monopoly in the public tax-supported education system, where they are able to exclude alternative ideas. Now, I may not agree with everything, every idea that a Christian creationist might have about the age of the earth, for example, but I think they have a right to present their ideas as long as they're not forcing anyone to accept them. If they're prepared to try to justify them in terms of scientific evidence and logic, I think they have a right to do that. And just as every person has a right to agree or disagree with them, or agree or disagree with me.
Right.
I think in a country that regards itself as democratic and free, I don't think we should give one group a monopoly in the education system, which unfortunately the supporters of the current materialistic theories of the origin of life and human life now have. I think that isn't right.
No.
So,
go on.
But that's
I have noticed that sometimes that you'll both cite similar evidence but looking at it differently.
Well, that happens all fields.
Right. Well, I mean,
all
like
fields of human life. You know, like for example, in any criminal trial, you know, the defense and prosecutor, the defending attorney and the prosecuting attorney are gonna look at the evidence in different ways and try to persuade the jury of interpretation of the evidence. So that can happen, and people have to be able to make up their own minds about how they're going to react to different people presenting, you know, evidence.
Well, I was thinking primarily.
Yeah.
I was thinking primarily of like anomalous evidence that mainstream science might dismiss. Like, you might see dinosaur footprints next to modern man's footprints, and mainstream science will just say, "Well, that's nothing." You'll look at it as evidence of the antiquity of man. They'll look at it as evidence that dinosaurs are more recent. You know, just that kind of a split.
Yeah. So one has to look at the whole, every aspect of what a person is saying and make up their own mind about it. I think every individual has a right to do that. I think in the public square, everyone should have a right to present their ideas, and no one group should be able to convince government to give them a monopoly in the public tax-supported education system. It would be like, you know, what if the government decided, well, it's going to only support, you know, one political party or one religion? Or, you know, it would be, I think, wrong. But at the present moment, the government is supporting the supporters of one scientific idea about the origin of human species. So,
well, has there been anyone else historically that has done what you're doing, combining science and religion, since religion has split up?
Yeah, there have been some interesting personalities who have tried to do that. One of them was Sir Isaac Newton in the world of physics. He integrated his spirituality and his science. I mean, now mostly he's understood and is famous for being the father of modern physics. I mean, everybody's familiar with the idea that, you know, he was the one who developed the laws of gravity. You know, there's the famous kind of folklore picture of him, you know, sitting under the apple tree and seeing the apple fall down and, you know, developing his understanding of the laws of gravity. And that's in all the science textbooks, but he saw his work is uncovering the way that God operates in the world. He wanted to know how God was operating in this world. And his physics and his optics and all the scientific work that he's rightly famous for him, was part of a larger project. And therefore, many aspects of his work are now excluded, you know, from the science textbooks, where, you know, he's dealing with things like alchemy and more spiritual aspects of the world that we live in. So he's one example. Another example is Alfred Russel Wallace, who was, along with Darwin, the co-founder of the theory of evolution by natural selection. So for a long time, the theory was called the Wallace-Darwin theory.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's no longer, his name is no longer mentioned in connection with the theory. And that's because at a certain point, he began actively trying to integrate his spiritual understanding with his scientific understandings about the origin of species. He came to the conclusion that there had to have been some higher intelligence involved in the origin of species. You couldn't explain it all by natural selection. He thought there had to be some intelligence that was guiding the process, and he also thought there had to be a non-material element involved in terms of consciousness having an existence apart from matter. So he began doing scientific research on these topics, and it resulted in a kind of a breach between him and Darwin. You know, Darwin said to him, wrote to him once, that by getting into these things, you're murdering our child, you know, the theory of evolution. So Alfred Russel Wallace was another figure. He was a very prominent biologist, a co-founder of the theory of evolution by natural selection, who was integrating spirituality into his scientific view of the world. So there have been others as well, but Sir Isaac Newton, Alfred Russel Wallace are two prominent figures.
Okay. Can you give us just a brief idea of what some of the papers in your new book are that are based on archaeology?
Yeah, well, the first paper that I presented at a scientific conference was called Pyrrhonic Time and the Archaeological Record. It was a paper that I presented at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that was held in New Delhi, India in 1994. The World Archaeological Congress is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists, and it meets every 4 years in a different country. So in that year, 1994, they happened to be meeting in India, and I thought, well, this would be the ideal place to present something like this. As I said, the Puranas are the historical writings of ancient India. They are the writings that contain this idea that humans have existed throughout vast cycles of time, going back, excuse me, many millions of years. And I think there's archaeological evidence to support that. So I presented this paper called Pyrrhonic Time and the Archaeological Record, and it was accepted for presentation at this major international scientific conference. And then later, it was selected to be published in a peer-reviewed scientific book called Time and Archaeology. So this is one of the papers that's included in this latest book, My Science, My Religion, that deals with archaeology. There are other papers that deal with archaeology, that deal with specific cases. For example, there was the paper that I presented at the meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that took place in Washington, D.C. I think it was in the year 2003, if I'm not mistaken. And that paper dealt with the California gold mine discoveries. During the gold rush days, miners went to California to get the gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains, like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And deep inside the tunnels, the miners were finding human bones and human artifacts in layers of rock that modern geologists tell us are about 50 million years old. So then there are other papers that deal with specific cases like that, the California gold mine discoveries, for example.
All right. What about the more paranormal side of things? What papers in it deal with that?
Well, you know, there's a major international scientific conference called Toward a Science of Consciousness that takes place every 2 years. And I've presented papers about how consciousness exists apart from matter and how the mind has some paranormal powers. So several of the papers in the book deal with that aspect of my work. For example, things such as the paranormal research carried out by the Curies, Pierre and Marie Curie. Every physics student, high school physics student, learns about the work of Pierre and Marie Curie. You know, they were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes for their work in discovering radium, you know, and they did this work early in the 20th century. That's in the high school physics textbook. But what you don't see is that they were heavily involved in psychical research, research into the paranormal. You know, they were part of a group of prominent European scientists who were conducting research with mediums. You know, mediums are people who possess paranormal powers. So they did 2 years of experiments with an Italian medium, a lady named Eusebia Palladino. And this woman had psychokinetic abilities, mind over matter abilities. For example, once they had this woman in a scientific laboratory, and they noted that a large table was floating 3 feet off the ground in the presence of this woman. And after 2 years of experiments where they scientifically demonstrated the reality of these phenomena, you know, the whole group of scientists, including the Curie, signed documents saying these things are absolutely true. But you're not going to see them mentioned in the physics textbooks. So some of my papers presented at scientific conferences deal with things like that.
Okay. There's also one that deals with a spiritual perspective on the current environmental crisis. Do you have any insights about that you'd like to share?
Yeah, that paper was called Divine Nature, and it was presented at a major international scientific conference on the environment. And my basic message there was that ultimately the environmental crisis is a spiritual crisis that demands a spiritual solution. The basic problem is this. You know, the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by the answers to the fundamental questions, who am I and where do I come from? So today, the mainstream scientists, through the monopoly they now have in the education systems around the world, are able to dictate to people the answers to those fundamental questions. And they're giving very materialistic answers. They're basically saying, we're machines made of matter in competition with each other for survival. Now, because our sense of identity determines our values and our goals and ambitions, it's no surprise to me that our whole worldwide civilization has taken a very materialistic turn, so that we think that to produce and consume more and more material things is the main purpose of human life. And in doing this, we are consuming the Earth's resources in an unsustainable way. We're deforesting the Earth, we're poisoning the air, poisoning the land, poisoning the water, consuming the Earth's resources at an unsustainable rate. It's the very root of our environmental crisis. And to change this, we have to go back to the very fundamental questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? I think we need new answers to those questions, new scientific answers to those questions that acknowledge the non-material aspect of our existence, that there is consciousness that is non-material, that is not produced by matter. If we had the understanding that we're beings of pure consciousness, I think we could live in this world in a more balanced way. We could bring our level of material production and consumption to a sustainable level. we would be able to produce the material needs of human society in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible, while putting more of our human energy into developing the resource of consciousness. And I think that is the ultimate solution to the environmental crisis, which is driven by this overproduction and overconsumption of material things.
All right. Wow, that's a very interesting perspective and very enlightened perspective on it.
One of the papers in this latest book, My Science, My Religion, deals with this topic.
All right. And you also have a study of anomalous fossil evidence for the extreme antiquity of plants?
Yeah, because that's a question that some people would come up with. Yeah, my book, Forbidden Archaeology, deals with archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, you know, evidence that humans have been around for longer than current scientific theories can accommodate, which means we need new scientific theories. So some people ask me, well, is it just the human species that we have to think about in a different way? Or what about the plants and the animals? Is their history different than we've been told in the textbooks? And my answer to that question is yes. We need to reevaluate our understanding of the history of other species beyond the human species. So most scientists now think that the flowering plants, the angiosperms, they're called technically, first came into existence about 100 million years ago. And when I say flowering plants, I don't just mean roses and lilies and things like that. Practically all the plants that we use for food are of the flowering plant family. All our vegetables, all our fruits, all our grains come from the flowering plant family. So most scientists now think the flowering plants began less than 100 million years ago. But in one of my papers in this new book, My Science, My Religion, I show there is scientific evidence that the flowering plants were existing hundreds of millions of years ago, up to 600 million years ago. And, you know, this evidence comes from studies, geological studies in the Salt Range Mountains of what's now Pakistan. And remains of flowering plants were found miles underneath the ground in some very ancient formations, over 600 million years old. And according to the current dominant ideas, at that time there should have been no life whatsoever on land. You know, they think there were just some primitive forms of life in the oceans at that time. You know, they think the very first primitive land plants came into existence about 400 million years ago, and the first flowering plants came into existence about 100 million years ago. So this evidence, documented in this paper and that I presented at a scientific conference, shows that we have to rethink not just our picture of human antiquity, but the antiquity of other species as well, including plants.
It is okay. So a lot of this dating is done by how far down someone has to get to before they find this stuff. Is it possible there have been cataclysms that have kind of screwed that up a little bit, mixed up the sediment layers a bit, that may be giving us false readings, either telling us things are newer or older than they actually are?
Yes, that is definitely something that has to be taken into account. And I take it into account in my work, and a lot of the archaeologists, geologists who have reported the kind of evidence that I've included in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, took that into account as well. You know, for example, there was a case from a place called Castagnatolo in northern Italy in the late 19th century. An Italian geologist named Giuseppe Rocazzoni found human skeletons in layers of rock about 3 or 4 million years old. And one possible explanation for that is, well, they could have slipped down into those very ancient layers of rock through some fissure in the ground, through some earth movement, or perhaps somebody died only a few thousand years ago and his friends dug a grave and put the body down into that ancient layer of rock. So these are things that definitely have to be considered. And Rogazzoni, being a professional geologist, did consider these things. And he looked very carefully. And as a professional geologist, he said, there's no evidence of any earth movements or fissures or cracks in the ground. Neither is there any evidence that somebody dug a grave. Because if that had happened, then all the layers of rock above the skeletons would have been disturbed. Because it's sort of like a layer cake, you know, where you have different layers of different colored rock. And if somebody had dug down through all those different layers, you would have noticed it. Or if there had been an earth movement, you would have noticed it. A professional geologist would have noticed it. So the kinds of things that you mentioned, they do have to be taken into account. And in the cases that I've documented in my work, those kinds of things have been considered and shown not to be the case.
Okay. All right. So we're about to wrap this up. I have a couple of quick questions for you. One, how old do you think man really is? Like, how old do you think modern man has been on this earth?
I think humans have been here since the very beginning of life on earth, which would go back a couple billion years.
Okay, and how advanced do you think some of these cultures got to be?
I think some of them got to be quite advanced. If we look at some of the historical records from ancient India, they describe civilizations that existed millions of years ago that had spacecraft. They were called vimanas. They had weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons. They had beautiful cities and things like that. So I think human civilizations have risen and fallen many times in the long history of the Earth.
Okay. And now your latest book, as we just said, is My Science, My Religion. When did this come out?
This came out at the end of 2012.
Okay. And you have a specific website for it that is MyScienceMyReligion.com.
That's correct.
And it's also available on Amazon, right?
It is, and it's also available on my main website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com.
All right, and anything else people should know about?
If they refer to my website, there's an interview link where, you know, they could see all my upcoming interviews. For example, if they'd gone there, they would have seen this interview announced. There's also a schedule link that shows upcoming speaking engagements. I'm going to be speaking at an event in Fort Wayne, Indiana in April. So there are, if they go to that website, they can see upcoming interviews and events.
Okay. Well, I do have one more question. What would you say is the oddest legitimate artifact you think we've ever dug up that points to the extreme antiquity of man?
Well, one very puzzling artifact is these round metallic objects that come from South Africa. They're very interesting. You know, they're 1 or 2 inches in diameter. They're made of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron. It's also a semi-precious stone. And the really interesting feature of these objects is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each one. Now, they're found in mineral deposits about over 2 billion years old. And they're just fascinating objects. I mean, maybe somebody could come up with a good explanation of how they could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth, but you know, some metallurgists have examined them, and they said they can't explain how they could have formed naturally in the layers of the Earth, which means we'd have to consider that perhaps some human-like intelligence was involved in producing them. So that's a fascinating case.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And mcremo.com, is it?
Yeah, mcremo.com.
All right. Thank you very much. And we're going to take you out with our outro song from Psyche Corporation. And thank you for all the work, Michael.
Thank you for your show. We've got to get this information out.
All right. We'll be back next week. Last Exit from the Lost is up next.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you?